We're back on the politics of food. I am Joy Hout, and I'm joined today by Nathan Callahan. And coming up in just a few days, March 18th, is National Biodiesel Day. And biodiesel and other so-called renewable fuels are entering the market as green alternatives to oil. And they have the promise of being sustainable and less polluting. Joining us today for some counterintelligence on this is Professor Tad Patzik of UC Berkeley. Welcome to the show, Mr. Patzik.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with the obvious question. Are some of the fuels that we're talking about, are they really renewable in the literal sense?
Right. Well, they're not as renewable as we would like to think. Mm-hmm. They are replaceable for some time, but they are not renewable according to a definition of renewability, which means that they do not do harm to the environment and they can be renewed for a very long period of time.
When we think about renewable resources, we think of things like water and sunlight, but there are a lot of other factors, such as soil. It's not necessarily renewable. It goes away after a certain time.
Absolutely. In fact, farming has been historically mining in part of natural resources, and the most important one of these resources is soil, but also farming causes widespread water pollution. And these two factors together make, in fact, industrial farming unsustainable and non-renewable.
And your particular area of expertise, you've done a lot of research on the conversion of corn into ethanol. One of the other promises of this energy is that it's, well, that it's worthwhile fuel, that it's we're essentially getting something for nothing. You know, it's and it burns clean and that sort of thing.
Yes. Well, you know, the problems are more or less the same. They are only problems of degree with mm-hmm. all biofuels. Mm-hmm. Corn ethanol, in fact, is probably one of the worst examples of biofuels because in addition to everything else, corn growing, farming, and its processing to ethanol requires enormous amounts of fossil energy. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you listen carefully to what the National Corn Growers Association is telling its members, you would learn that, in fact, one of their priorities is to increase production of natural gas, crude oil, and coal to satisfy the ever-growing needs of industrial agriculture.
So, in effect, while consumers are being sold on the idea that this is an alternative to oil dependency, it, in effect, increases our dependency on oil.
Well, one has to be sort of careful here. It does increase our dependency on natural gas mm-hmm. much more so right. than our dependency on oil. The major component of farming is, in fact, natural gas and coal. Oil comes last.
Can you put that in layman's terms? How is natural gas used as an input in industrial farming?
Well, industrial farming uses natural gas in the form of nitrogen fertilizer,
okay.
Which is almost pure methane transformed into ammonia and its derivatives. It is also using natural gas for pumping of irrigation water, drying of corn, heating the buildings, and all sorts of other things that require heat and energy. Also remember that natural gas, to some degree, is now being used to generate electricity, and farming uses also a lot of electricity. So natural gas and coal are, in fact, pervasive fuels in industrial farming, and they cannot be sort of, you know, brushed aside as an insignificant contribution. One of the people who emailed me, and there's many of them, in fact, called industrial farming and fuel processing laundering of fossil fuels, and I think that's a very apt mm-hmm. terminology, mm-hmm. because suddenly you stop talking about the dirty fossil fuels, you're talking about clean, renewable energy,
right,
and
right.
everybody feels happy.
Right. Well, and natural gas, just to go back to that really quick, I think to the extent that people are aware of fuel shortages, they're more aware of the oil situation, and natural gas hasn't really entered the consciousness.
Yes, and yet. It should.
And it should, because it's entering shortages as well.
Oh, absolutely. Remember that we are now, the United States is importing a 15% of natural gas, mostly from Canada, but these imports will have to grow dramatically with time, because despite the heroic measures of the gas producers who drill tens of thousands of wells every year everywhere, in fact destroying the whole interior of the United States, we will not be able to keep up with the demand, and we will have to import increasingly large quantities of natural gas. Now, we will probably switch to importing liquefied natural gas, which is also a very, environmentally costly mm-hmm. way of delivering natural gas.
Now, you said that with ethanol in particular, it's 3 to 4 times less efficient than gasoline or coal in terms of energy output.
Yes.
But this, as you know, conflicts with other scientific results. How do you explain the difference?
Well, it's a long story, so I'll try to summarize it very briefly. Since we are, as a nation, absolutely obsessed with fossil fuels, mm-hmm. we disregard doing the fundamental science of these biofuel cycles. And so we pick and choose certain terms in the mass and energy balances of these cycles, and then we draw our conclusions. If you want to do a complete mass balance, which means mass in equals mass out, and also energy balance, you will find out that, in fact, you are using in an ethanol refinery between 5 and 12 times more energy to produce ethanol from corn than you would to produce diesel fuel or gasoline from crude oil. And that's just a fact. Also, remember that industrial agriculture does not have an overall efficiency of 1. That is, solar energy in equals, grain out.
Mm-hmm.
It uses up environment to an unprecedented degree.
And unmeasured degree.
I'm sorry?
And an unmeasured degree.
That's right. And another, that's a very good point. And another point that I would like to make is that we do not actually track the extent of the usage of environment or destruction of environment by the industrial agriculture. And this needs to be done, accounted for, and in fact, I did some rough estimates, and then you will come up with an overall efficiency of corn farming between 1/2 and maybe 0.6 if you're lucky.
Wow. And some of these other studies, it looks overall like they're behaving like good scientists should. They're leaving out of the equation important parts of natural systems.
That's right.
And
this is actually a very important point. You cannot pick and choose what you like or dislike in science. You have to take the whole package. Otherwise, you are in fact behaving, just like Enron accountants, for example. Or, to put it in different form, you are violating the fundamental laws of physics, and you can't do that. In fact, the U.S. Patent Bureau would reject any patent application that would violate the first law and the second law of thermodynamics, since has been doing so since 1917. So it's kind of awkward to go back and in 2006 try to propose schemes that violate the laws of thermodynamics.
Nathan, you sound like you have a thought.
Well, I'm curious about the General Motors campaign that we hear so much about these days, the Live Green, Go Yellow.
Yes.
What does that practically mean? When a company like General Motors gets behind a project like that, are they simply talking about more farm subsidization here in the United States, or are we talking about going into the rainforest and clearing
of
that?
Well, I would like to make 2 points here. One, I don't think that General Motors cares about farm subsidies. General Motors is struggling for its own survival. Mm. And I think it's a desperate move of a desperate company which has obsolete products and tries to sell them. So instead of going after the market for more efficient and more durable and better cars, General Motors is selling another empty image. So that's the first point. The second point is actually probably even more important. If we get hung up on using biofuels to a degree which is larger than, let's say, 0.5% of all fuel used in the United States, maybe 1% if we're lucky, then we are encroaching on sources of supply which will have to be developed or are being developed in the tropics. And that's not only for the United States, but also primarily for Europe. These huge, gigantic plantations, mostly of palm oil, of oil palms that will produce palm oil, which is much more efficient than rapeseed and soybeans in producing biodiesel, they will in fact destroy the most important and vital life-sustaining ecosystems on the earth. So I would like to warn the biofuel enthusiasts, especially biodiesel enthusiasts, from refraining from greeting a tanker from Colombia or from Indonesia with palm oil with great hooray, because they should be wearing black bands. You know, another ecosystem died, and we are witnessing a funeral of many of those ecosystems.
What about the land that we have under intense agriculture now in this country? Is that viable at all? I mean, looking around, for example, in California, we see fields and fields and fields.
Right. Well, you see, we have to define what viability. Mm-hmm. Viability, we would like to think, would be something that will survive, let's say, for another 50 years. I have a very hard time imagining many of these very large agricultural systems surviving more than 50 years. Remember that in Iowa today, more than half of the topsoil is gone, mm-hmm. It's eroded away. And the remaining half is eroding rather quickly as well. If you look at California, it's enormously mm-hmm. subsidized by water. It's desert.
Imported water.
Mm-hmm. Imported water and also fossil fuels, you know, the fertilizers. And because of this very intense agriculture, it's being deteriorated rather rapidly. Just, you know, drive along Highway 5 from San Francisco to Los Angeles and see if you like what you see around you. It looks like an old-fashioned industrial region full of pollution, dirty brown air, and, you know, and in my mind, a really run-down desert.
I don't know anyone who enjoys driving that stretch. Everyone
exactly.
complains about it.
So if you believe what you see with your own eyes, you kind of have to you know, think about how long will it last, despite, and I must say, heroic and measures of the agricultural engineers who got very good at, you know, trying to keep the system going. But the problem is, no matter what they do, that system has to break down in another couple of decades. And we are trying to think about sources of energy for humanity which are renewable. That means mm-hmm. they will be renewed for another 100 or 200 years, but they won't be.
Right. We're still talking about finite inputs.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So therefore, if you are a biodiesel enthusiast and you got your biodiesel from your McDonald's or even better, a local Indian restaurant because it's better quality oil, and you made all the decisions to drive less because you have a limited supply of fuel, great. I'm extremely happy for you, and I really do support it. Mm-hmm. But you have to understand that you are just one person, and the other 99 people are driving on fossil fuels. So somehow we have to come around to the realization that these biofuels will not suffice to make us happy and drive forever. We will have to drive less. And, you know, sitting in Los Angeles, I think you have an acute example of not being able to drive less. And so, therefore, not only will we have to drive less, but we will have to drive much more efficient cars. which are not produced by General Motors, by the way, or by Ford, and
really?
That's why they're going out of business. But in addition, we will have to redesign our cities so that you do not have to drive for every errand, for every little thing you ever want to do in your life. And so this means very large restructuring of our society to make it more efficient. Now, nobody's talking about these things. They don't even enter the equation. We're all worried about the net fossil energy balance of corn ethanol, which is a non-issue.
Right. I want to remind everyone we're talking with Tad Patzik. He's professor of engineering at Berkeley. Like you were saying, it's... We want a nice, clean equation that only has variables that we can control and that aren't frightening.
Correct. That's correct. And in fact, you know, just yesterday, I think there was a CNN poll in which, you know, Congressman Bartlett, Roscoe Bartlett, has commented on. He's the only congressman that I know of who's talking openly, and he's a Republican, who's talking about, you know, calling to conserve energy and get out of this madness, but he's just a lonely voice out there. So CNN poll, I think, has showed that 3/4 of Americans are painfully aware that there will be a diminishing supply of oil in their lifetimes, and many of them are also afraid that there will be a major attack on oil-producing installations somewhere in the world. And so everybody's scared. Scared people make sometimes uninformed decisions.
Well, it also makes it makes them easy targets for marketing of things like, you know, something green.
Absolutely.
You know, well, to get away from driving a little bit, only
yes.
because this is the politics of food.
Yes.
I think many people would be startled to learn how much, again, fossil fuels are a required input for the production of everything that they eat.
Yes.
How do these potential, you know, if we can discount all of their associated drawbacks of uh-huh. these bioenergies, could they possibly ever be self-sustaining in terms of agricultural production?
Well, this is a very difficult question, and I have to tell you that the United States uses about 10% of all energy that we use every year on food production and processing. Majority of this energy, in fact, is not used on the farm. It is used on refrigeration and on heavy chemical processing mm-hmm. of food, but also on transportation.
Transport. Mm-hmm.
All food in the United States is being driven in a refrigerated truck more or less 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And so there will have to be structural changes in the agriculture. There will have to be a redevelopment of local markets so that people eat local foods, not foods flown or driven from thousands of miles away and refrigerated. We will have to use different ways of organizing agriculture around a more diverse ecosystems with several kinds of plants being grown, and to lessen erosion and to lessen the depletion of nutrients. And many of these things are being done worldwide. There are beautiful examples, you know, in Thailand, in Indonesia, and many other places of rice paddies, which are grown or developed with ducks, with many other natural things that do not take so much fossil energy, yet they achieve yields higher or as high as some of the heavily subsidized industrial rice paddies. So it is possible. It is also very, very difficult because the structure of our agriculture
exactly.
is precisely wrong to do that.
And
concentration of production in these mega companies and mega firms, which will not, you know, on their own change because they receive so much money from in subsidies to sustain the existing system.
And we don't have a living structure that supports it either. Our guest earlier on the show today was a representative of a huge Los Angeles urban farm.
Uh-huh.
And it supports about 350 different families, each on their own little plot, 14 acres.
Yes.
Self-sustaining. It feeds them, and they're about to be evicted to put up a warehouse.
Oh, my. Well, this is in fact a crime against humanity. It really is. It's nothing less than that. If we think in these terms that the warehouse is more important than feeding people and providing sustainable agriculture, then we are actually jumping off a precipice. And I have an uneasy feeling that many of us are.
And it doesn't only affect those, 400 families who are maybe low income. It affects all of us up across the economic scale because we all have to eat.
Absolutely. And so you've added another very important element about which we need to start talking, how to reform our agriculture. Now, some of these decisions will be made without the United States. By 2012, the European Union will cut down on their lavish subsidies, even higher than our subsidies, because they cannot look, in the eye the Brazilians or the Indians or Africans, for that matter, mm-hmm. and say, well, as long as we spend $1 billion a day to sustain our farming operations that we do not need, we're okay. But we are putting you out of business, and we're making you poor, and you cannot feed your own people.
It's been called colonialism all over again.
Oh, absolutely! But now we don't. You know, that's right. We are not using the old colonial language. Now we are using language such as sustainability,
right.
Green agriculture, future solutions, green fuels, and all this obfuscating language mm-hmm. that makes people feel good about things which are terrible.
It's. I noticed in another interview that I heard of yours where that language came up very often, and it was very useful in that you can tell when the conversation effectively shuts down when they use the word sustainability. Well, we'll just make it sustainable as if that's
yes.
a fact and not just a thought.
Right. Well, sustainability is, in fact, very difficult to define, and it requires some very careful thinking. I have tried to define it. Actually, I have defined it. It's a very abstract and very difficult goal, which is not achieved by anything we are talking about today. And so sustainability is one of the most abused terms, again, with its intended soothing effect on the public. Almost everything we do is either viciously unsustainable or very unsustainable. It's not even somewhat unsustainable. And so that includes industrial agriculture. It's very unsustainable. And so we perhaps should refrain from abusing this word even more.
Ted Padzik, I'm sorry to let you go.
That's okay. It was a pleasure.
thank you for being with us today on The Politics of Food. Where can listeners get more information? Where's the basic place to start?
Well, the listeners can just type in my last name into Google and then go to my new webpage, and on it there is a biofuel Q&A, and there is a lot of information about different aspects of biofuels. So just my last name, and then try to find me.
How do you spell your last name again?
P-A-T-Z-E-K, Patek.
Okay, great. We're going to wrap it up here on The Politics of Food. Thank you for joining us today, Dr. Patek.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.